Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes Imbolo Mbue, author of Behold the Dreamers, a compulsively readable debut novel about marriage, immigration, class, race, and the trapdoors in the American dream. The unforgettable story of a young Cameroonian couple making a new life in New York just as the Great Recession upends the economy. Thursday, March 15th at 6:30 p.m. More at theivybookshop.com or 410-377-2966.
Hello again from the Baltimore Sun. I'm Dan Rodericks, Sun columnist, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 369 for Thursday, March 15th, 2018. The Washington Post reports that Donald J. Trump boasted in a fundraising speech Wednesday that he made up information about trade deficits in a meeting with Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Trump often fabricates or exaggerates, but this time he did it while in discussion with an important U.S. ally and trade partner, then admitted to it, even seemed to think it was amusing. Here's some of the commentary and reaction from the Cuomo Camerata New Day show this morning on CNN.
And everybody but the Trump base knows that the president flagrantly abuses the truth. It's not just that the president is bragging about lying, right? This is part of the Manhattan real estate developer persona, right? But it also is the personal disrespect he's showing Justin Trudeau. Look, presidential words matter. This is basic, and they do not matter to President Trump. And what's more, he brags about lying.
I mean, here's the thing about Donald Trump. We know that he lies. And I'm sorry, for you out there that are watching right now that don't think that Donald Trump is lying, then that's a bigger problem than him actually lying.
That last voice was Mark Preston, a political analyst on CNN. And I have to agree, people who, at this point, accept without question statements that Trump makes might be a bigger problem, indeed a bigger threat to our democracy, than having a president who frequently lies. Today on the show, calling out BS. If you need help figuring out fact from fiction, you can now take a course in discerning one from the other. It's being offered starting next week at Anne Arundel Community College. You'll hear about that in a minute. And then later in the show, how calling out BS actually is done when a professional journalist, a veteran journalist, Arnold Skip Isaacs, shares what he learned when he questioned the Trump administration claim that a lax U.S. immigration system had put Americans at risk by allowing hundreds of foreign-born terrorists into the country. Stay tuned to hear why that claim is bogus. We start today's show with David Tengwall, a longtime professor at Anne Arundel Community College, who on Monday will start teaching an 8-week course called Calling Out Bullshit. It promises to be a fun course, Tengwall says, but the reason for it is serious. Americans have been inundated with BS in politics and in commerce, and we need help in detecting deceptions. Above all, he says, a well-informed citizenry engaged in critical thinking is vital to democracy.
The course originated at the University of Washington. There were two professors there, one a biologist, another a computer scientist, who originated the course in the spring of 2017, and they put their syllabus on the internet. They actually encouraged other instructors throughout the country, and as it's turned out, throughout the world, to basically use their syllabus as a kind of template to teach this course at their colleges. For example, Oxford is teaching this course, Princeton, I believe Harvard. As far as I know, right now, I think Anne Arundel Community College is the only community college. But when I saw the syllabus, I became extremely intrigued. I don't know if you've walked a college campus lately, but basically, especially go to a school like Anne Arundel, and the kids are walking the hallways with their nose and their iPhones, and basically they're being inundated with information that there is absolutely no filter on, and they have no way of knowing if it's absolutely right, absolutely wrong, what have you. You know, as a society, we are being so inundated with information that is not accurate. And so I almost kind of taken it on as, and I don't mean to be too self-promoting here, almost as a kind of almost like a civic responsibility to kind of initiate a means by which individuals can discern what is or is not bullshit. Just for example, in the year 2016, the Oxford Dictionary word of the year was post-truth. And they defined this as an adjective relating or demoting circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal belief. It was selected because its usage has increased to such a tremendous degree that we are besieged by it.
You know, it comes to mind as you were speaking, you mentioned the Oxford Dictionary. When I was a student, we had encyclopedias, we had texts to go look into for objective information about things. We were advised to do that. I don't remember ever having to stop and take a course on bullshit, you know, discerning bullshit from objective fact. Of course, I was a journalism student, and we had some instruction in how to discern what is truth and what is not truth. But I don't remember the academy ever offering a course in discernment from bullshit. I mean, do you?
Personally, no. I mean, I remember reading books, or you turned on the TV, and there was basically three news channels, and Walter Cronkite was like a god. You would never question whatever Walter Cronkite said, or Harry Reasoner, or Brinkley, Huntley and Brinkley.
Right.
You know, if you remember, they all had the same factual content. And now what has happened, you turn on whatever news show that you do, in fact, watch, even the factual information has now been altered. And that's what's so disconcerting for me. This course, I think, is so valuable in order for individuals to really be able to understand what they are hearing, what they're seeing, what they're experiencing in a matter that is beneficial, not detrimental or negative. And I'd like to emphasize, this is not a political course. This is a philosophy course, number one, but it's not a political course. It's a course that is aimed at really looking at how statistics, how charts and graphs have been distorted or used for distortion. About two-thirds of this course, if you actually look at my syllabus, two-thirds of this course is actually aimed at educating the student in regards to simply being able to discern what bullshit is or is not. The last third, we are looking at specific areas. I'm going to be looking at, for example, bullshit in advertising, obviously, bullshit in business, bullshit in food, whether it's organic or not organic, how does it become organic, things like that, or medicine. Obviously, one of the big controversies a few years ago about vaccines. Obviously, I am going to cover politics. You can't avoid that. So it's a course that is aimed at primarily educating everyone on how to be more critical in what they see and what they hear. I don't want, and this is also something I'm going to emphasize in the very beginning of the course, I don't want to have the student to become cynical. I want them to become critical of what they see, what they hear, what they experience, and then from that determine their own truth, if you will. But these poor kids today are so inundated with technology. And you were talking about Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. In 2016, I'll ask you this question. Do you know what the number one fake news bullshit story in 2016 was?
Probably something about Hillary Clinton, I'm guessing. I don't know.
No. The number one story was Pope Francis endorses Donald Trump.
Oh, Trump. Yeah, I remember that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah.
And it was initiated by a young kid in Romania. And it got almost a million hits. And he made money because every time it was hit upon and then spread and shared and all of this, he was making money. But it was completely bullshit. And that's the kind of thing that goes through cyberspace completely unfiltered. And that's the problem that we have, not just in our society. I mean, this class has now gone worldwide. I mean, there's schools in Europe that are going to be offering courses that are variations of this. For a true democracy to work, we need to be able to detect this kind of wrong information, because we do need, for a democracy to work to its optimum, a critical thinking electorate. I mean, it is that important. I'm at a stage in my career where I really probably shouldn't be doing this. I mean, I've been teaching for a very long time at Anne Arundel, but it has really initiated, kind of invigorated me, and also kind of ignited a spark in me that I think really this needs to be done. It's almost like I'm on a personal mission, if you will.
How much of this course do you think is devoted to just identifying credible sources? You cite the story of the Pope endorsing Donald Trump, a false story. Wouldn't it have been easy for people just to detect the source of that story? If it didn't come from the New York Times, it didn't come from Reuters, it didn't come from a trusted news agency. Do people really have that difficult a time in discerning the veracity of a story based on the source?
Well, one of the things about the news that we encounter, most people watch or read news agencies that automatically reinforce the ideas that we already have. A person that watches Fox News does so in order to reinforce their more conservative feelings, versus a person watches MSNBC in order to reinforce their more liberal ideas. And that's where actually the problem is, where we don't have a kind of dialogue or an interconnection. I'm actually going to suggest to the students that they kind of think outside the box and actually begin to read and view agencies or news sources that they normally would not. Now, in regards to the New York Times and the Washington Post, again, when you and I were in college, you know, they were considered, you know, without question.
Wait a minute. I want to go back to your point about people gravitating to sources of news that make them comfortable with it or reinforce their prejudices. Even those people can identify the iron core of news, you know, basic news, wire service reporting. Is this true or isn't this true? This is a credible source, Reuters, Associated Press, New York Times, Washington Post. You know, people may say, well, those newspapers have biases, but still, they provide most of the enterprise news that comes through this country, comes over the wires, comes into our homes. Isn't it easy enough just to check that source? I'm not saying those are the only sources, but I'm saying those are the most credible in terms of news.
What you said there is correct. The problem is having them to actually check. See, they don't, again, they watch or they read what they want, and it reinforces what they already believe, and they don't go any further than that.
I get you, yeah.
They're not, in other words, this is a course to actually kind of change the whole mindset of a way a person virtually almost lives their lives in becoming more critical in what they see and in what they hear. And not just to accept whatever is put in front of them by whatever news agencies that they are most inclined to read or to listen to.
Okay.
So what you're saying is right on the mark. But what I'm trying to encourage people to now become is more critical of everything that they hear and see, and actually take the time, take the energy to determine whether it is correct or not. One of the interesting things about the internet, we've become skimmers. Psychologists have actually said that, you know, we kind of read the first sentence, and it kind of, again, reinforces. And oftentimes, just reading the first sentence, and then, hey, this is a good story, and we'll pass it on to somebody on Facebook, you know, and we won't really have gone through the whole article, let's say. And I'm going to have examples of where that actually has happened, and it's been detrimental. And the person that just read, for example, the first line or the first paragraph, and then wrote about that or disseminated that out on the internet, has made a major mistake. It is literally trying to change their whole attitude towards the information that they receive on a daily basis. It's hard. It's going to be hard. I mean, we have become, as several psychologists that I'm going to be using say, you know, we become just skimmers. You know, we just skim what a lot of times in regards to what we do read.
Well, thank you for your time and good luck.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, sir.
David Tengwall is a longtime professor at Anne Arundel Community College. His course, Calling Out Bullshit, commences on Monday. He says there's still time to sign up for the 8-week course, which meets at 2 p.m. on Mondays and Wednesdays. More information in the notes that accompany today's episode. I'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Quinn Kelly, and I host a weekly podcast for the Baltimore Sun called Female Trouble. Each Tuesday, we feature a new long-form conversation with one of the area's most interesting and accomplished women, from public officials and congresswomen to rappers and restaurant owners. You can find Female Trouble on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Find more info at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble.
And on the latest episode of Female Trouble, Quinn Kelly speaks with educator, black mom, activist, and WEAA radio host Kay Wise Whitehead. Now, cutting through the BS on terrorism and immigration. Short story about a man named Ansar Mahmood. A few weeks after the 9/11 attacks, Mahmood, a legal immigrant from Pakistan, was taking photographs along the Hudson River one day, and a security guard called police to report that a Muslim-looking man might be photographing a nearby reservoir and water treatment facility. Investigators quickly concluded that Mahmood had no connection to terrorism, but found that he had registered a car and co-signed a lease for a Pakistani couple who overstayed their visas and were in the U.S. illegally. Mahmood was quickly cleared of any suspicion of terrorist activity, and yet his name still appears on the Justice Department's list of terrorism and terrorism-related convictions. The names of his friends also appear on the list, though they were found guilty of visa violations and obtaining false IDs, but with no suggestion of any connection to terror. Veteran journalist Arnold Skip Isaacs says these cases and others similar to them are counted in the data the Trump administration cites as proof that a large majority of defendants convicted in U.S. terrorism cases since 9/11 were born outside the United States, including such cases as evidence of a too lax immigration system is plainly deceptive, or BS. But Skip Isaacs says it serves Trump's aim to incite fear and hostility and harden immigration policy. In January, we had a very specific claim made by the president that 3 out of 4 acts of terrorism or violence in the United States of a terrorist nature are committed by foreign-born people.
The 3 out of 4 referred to convictions in federal courts for international terrorism or terrorism-related offenses. The numbers came in a report that was issued by the Justice and Homeland Security Departments saying that they didn't release the list, but that they had identified 402 of those convicted defendants. Now, these are people who stood trial and were convicted in federal court for international terrorism or terrorism-related charges.
402 out of...
They said at least 549, wasn't it?
402 of 549 persons found guilty in terror-related trials since 9/11. So this goes back to just after 9/11.
Yeah. So that's where the 3 out of 4 came from. In his first speech a year earlier, his first speech to Congress, Trump said the vast majority of individuals convicted of terrorism and terrorism-related offenses since 9/11 came here from outside our country. And then in the same speech, he said that we need to reform immigration, the immigration system, because, quote, we cannot allow a beachhead of terrorism to form inside America. So he blames loose immigration for a large number of terrorist offenses in the United States.
You wanted to take a deeper look at this, and you did. What did you find?
Well, I found that there's a sort of a two-step deception here. One, the data on convictions doesn't really prove anything like the dimensions of the threat that they want you to believe it is. The actual degree of or level of terrorism in the United States isn't anywhere even close to what that suggests, you know, hundreds of cases. And then the second level of distortion is that Trump and Attorney General Sessions and the Homeland Security Secretary misrepresent their own already flawed data, and they exaggerate it even further, even beyond what that data actually say. And that also exaggerates the threat. And connecting that threat to immigration, the message is that the immigration system is too loose. Bad people are slipping through immigration screening and getting into this country to do bad things to Americans. There are almost no cases where that's there are none that I could find where that's really conclusively proven.
Where, say, an adult male comes
right.
into the United
somebody
States.
Somebody snuck into the country.
Yeah. Or snuck in or just got through it legally?
No, I mean, got through the immigration screen, somehow
okay.
evaded being,
right.
you know, got in, yes, got
and
in legally.
And then carried out a bombing or something.
With the intent to carry yeah. out a terrorist act.
Yeah.
There are only two or three cases where that's even plausible, not hundreds, and not even double digits.
And you know this from looking at what was made available by the government. The
yeah. There are three different ways in which the data are flawed. One, the terrorism-related convictions, the total number of convictions, and this was through the end of 2016, was not 549, but it was up like 667, I think, or 668, terrorism-related convictions. A lot of those cases had nothing to do with terrorism.
Well, why are they called terrorism-related?
Well,
give me an example of what you
okay.
mean.
Okay. I can give you several examples. The short answer is that some of them started off with a terrorism investigation, and then the investigation didn't show any terrorist link, but they found, you know, something else to charge these people with, typically a sort of an immigration fraud of some kind. And there was never any evidence terrorism had anything to do with it, but because they started off as a terrorism-related case, then they stayed on this list.
Oh, okay.
That modified to some extent in later years, but that's where a big number of them come from. Another distortion is that most of these cases, the big majority, did not involve anything having to do with a terrorist act or a planned terrorist act in the United States. Many, many more had to do with, quote, material support for terrorism someplace else.
People,
somebody trying to go to Syria
yeah,
or Somalia.
But someone who had come into the United States as an immigrant, either as a child or grown up here or came in as an adult, and then the allegations against them involved an act overseas, a terrorist act overseas?
Not even that. I mean, a handful of them, I guess, actually got overseas, but more of them were trying to get out of the country to go to join jihadis in Somalia or Syria. Those are the two destinations. But a larger number were not accused themselves of trying to go someplace else and do terrorist things, but supporting somebody.
Supporting, okay.
So sometimes they supported an individual, gave a guy money to buy a plane ticket or whatever it is, or in quite a few cases supported a charity or an ostensible charity that is on the government's terrorist list. So some of those people probably knew the guy they were helping wanted to go and shoot people or blow things up. But a lot of them may have thought that the guy was going to do charitable work because that is how these organizations present themselves,
mm-hmm.
and some of them genuinely. So in any given case, you really can't, I mean, at least I can't find out whether the defendant knew that he or she was supporting a terrorist. Some number of those were unknowing. Another flaw in the data has to do with the connection with immigration, because a large number of these defendants had been in the United States for years.
Had come as children.
And many of them had come as children, or even if they'd come as adults, had been many years ago. There's a large number of, I believe in the Justice Homeland Security report, if I'm remembering the number correctly, of those 402 foreign-born, I think it was 148 were naturalized citizens. So they'd been in the country for at least 5 years after however many years it took them to get lawful permanent residence. So in all probability, the big majority of those cases, they didn't come in as radicals intending to do bad things. they were radicalized. The ones who were, many of them weren't radicalized ever, but the ones who were radicalized became radicalized after coming to the United States. There's not one but two different analyses were done in the Homeland Security Department, and these were completed after the president administration took office, that concluded that that was the typical pattern, that more terrorism cases come from, in this country, come from people who adopted radical views after coming through immigration. So they wouldn't have been caught by any screening because they weren't dangerous they came.
So the suggestion that we have a lax immigration system, that suggestion is that, like I said before, you know, an adult comes into the United States meaning to commit an act of terror against the domestic population. That's, you know, that's what Trump presents. That's what he suggests.
That's the implication. And there are almost no cases that actually show that pattern. And one more big distortion, a substantial number of the cases didn't come through immigration at all. They were extradited. They were taken into U.S. custody abroad someplace, captured by U.S. forces.
After 9/11.
In Iraq and in Somalia and all kinds of places. Or they were turned over to the United States by foreign governments and extradited. Researchers for something called a Lawfare blog, which is an affiliate with the Brookings Institution, went through an earlier list, and they found about 100 cases of defendants who were convicted but who had not come into the United States through any immigration process but who were already in American custody and transported here to be prosecuted and tried for their acts. So out of those 402, which is actually not the definitive number anyway, but if you take that number, that's the one they're publicizing now, a quarter of those don't tell you anything at all about it. They don't have anything to do with the immigration system. They didn't come through passport control anywhere.
Still, the president says what he says. The Justice Department puts out this report, and it, you know, supports those who already agree with the president that we should be clamping down on immigration, especially from majority Muslim countries.
Yeah, that's the message.
And also, the president wants to do away with the diversity visa lottery system and chain migration, which is basically, I don't know where this term came from, chain migration, but it's so that you can bring family into the United States, right?
Well, I guess they call it chain migration because if I immigrate and then I get a member of my family in under family reunification, then that person can then sponsor another member of his family, so it does sort of connect.
It sounds a little more sinister than family reunification.
Well, language matters.
But that's what this is about. Yes, language matters, and the president matters, even if it is Donald Trump. You know, I appreciate your analysis of this, but you know, when the president makes a statement like that, this concern about evil coming into the United States through a lax immigration system, in order to counter it, as you've just done, it still seems like it's a day late, you know, that you're counting on people being willing to have an open mind and a curious mind and wanting to know more and being skeptical of what the president says. You're counting on people to read newspapers.
All you can do is try to find out the facts. I mean, this is what we've always done, you and I, going back many years.
Yeah.
Find out the facts and tell people what they are as best we can. And how people absorb those and how much attention they pay and how much it affects their views is really beyond our control. I mean, I think that on these issues, these immigration and terrorism issues, you have a huge kind of irrational component to public attitudes. And that's what these phony statistics play on, is fear. You know, there's another statistic that is worth mentioning here. Foreign-born terrorists have actually killed very, very few people in the last 15 years compared to native-born terrorists. Even if you only count Islamic extremist-inspired terrorism, many more of those were killed in the lethal acts, the ones that actually killed somebody in the United States. They're not on this justice list because they were killed. The attackers were killed, so they didn't stand trial. They weren't convicted. Two of those cases, the case in Orlando and the case in San Bernardino, California, killed three times as many people. In California, there was a husband and wife. The husband was native born in the U.S., and the wife was an immigrant from Pakistan. They killed 14 people. And the guy in Orlando...
From New York.
He was born on Long Island.
Yeah.
So, you know, those two, all by themselves, killed more people than foreign-born terrorists have killed in the entire 15 years, 16 years since 9/11.
And, you know, as we record this podcast today, high school students across the country are walking out for 17 minutes to mourn the 17 killed in Parkland and the high school there, and to protest the availability of guns and high-powered assault rifles in the United States. When you think about that in that context, that much broader context of violence in America.
If you include, as I say, I mean, the native-born far outnumber foreign-born, even in Islamic extremist terrorism.
Right, even in that narrow.
If you include sort of right-wing ideological terrorism, the disparity is greater. And then if you include all these, you know, mass shootings by people who are not for any ideological purpose but who are mentally deranged, you have many times as many people killed by nutcases with assault weapons.
Americans.
Yeah.
Us killing us.
Native-born Americans.
Yeah, I just think it's important to keep that in mind, too, when you consider what the president wants to do. He wants to change our immigration system.
And he wants to do it by making you scared that immigrants are dangerous and that Muslim immigrants are dangerous in a specific way. And one of the most chilling things to me in this last report in January, the Justice Homeland report, it's a footnote. They show foreign-born, foreign nationals. And the administration tends to refer to all these people as foreign nationals, although a naturalized citizen is not a foreign national. They're foreign-born, but not a foreign national. But they call them all foreign nationals. Not in the report, but in their speech. But then they showed 147 of the 549 were U.S. citizens by birth. And then there's a footnote. Information pertaining to the citizenship status of the parents of those 147 individuals was not available at the time of this report's issuance. And then the White House put out a fact sheet at the same time, and they made the same point. And then they went on and put in a sentence that said, terrorist attacks carried out by children of foreign-born individuals include the attack in Orlando by Omar Mateen, which killed 49 people and wounded more than 50 others, and the attack in San Bernardino, California, by Saeed Rizwan Farouk, which killed 14 people and injured 22 others. Now, if you stop and think about it, what does that footnote have to do with the subject of the report was the risk of foreign-born terrorists. So what do crimes by U.S.-born attackers have to do with it?
What's the reference to parents?
Exactly. That's what I mean.
Yeah.
And it certainly doesn't tell you anything about weakness in the immigration system. If you had a shooter who was born, you know, Farouk was born in Chicago and Mateen was born in Long Island. So, you know, they weren't here because they got through a weak immigration control. But what it does fit is this vision of a world that's under threat from dangerous Muslims. And why else would that even be mentioned? Perhaps those reference to children of foreign-born individuals were not meant to cast suspicion on the entire Muslim American community. Possibly the White House and the Justice Department were not intentionally stoking public hostility and fear by implying that all Muslims, whether immigrants or born in the United States, should be regarded as potentially disloyal or dangerous. But if there's a less chilling motive, it's hard to imagine what it could be. If facts can overcome irrational fear, then we could take a sane look at immigration and at these other issues. But to look at, for example, the American Muslim community as a danger, and that's a strong current of that in American public thinking now, but it is just not supported by any evidence. Muslim Americans, you know, have lower crime rates than the whole, as do immigrants in general, than the native-born population. The number of Muslim Americans who've been involved in any kind of terrorists, of extremist terrorist activity, is minimal, really minimal. when you look at a Muslim American, or for that matter, a foreign visitor, you know, your first thought shouldn't be that this guy could be a terrorist, because the incidence is, it's almost an invisible fraction.
Arnold R. Skip Isaacs, a journalist, author, and former editor and correspondent for The Sun, lives in Maryland, and his story, Using Fake Facts to Make Us Afraid, is posted on tomdispatch.com. You can find a link to it in the notes with today's episode. And that's our show for now. Your thoughts are welcome by email, by Twitter, or on Facebook. Please review our show on iTunes if you get a chance. For producers Steve Early and Quinn Kelly, I'm Dan Rodericks. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking from the Baltimore Sun, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes author of historical thrillers Steve Barry, whose latest book, The Bishop's Pawn, introduces the first case for his iconic hero, Cotton Malone. On the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., this is a gripping and provocative thriller about an American icon. Friday, March 23rd at 7 p.m. More at theivybookshop.com or 410-377-2966.